This is CliffCentral.com.
Yeah, a little Chainsmokers and the one before that, Katy Perry and California Girls. Featuring Snoop, Ben says that that was when Snoop needed money. Because why else would he ever want to do work with Katy Perry?
Oh, wow.
That is so disrespectful to Uncle Snoop.
No, I think it's disrespectful to Katy Perry. All right, we're going to sit down and have a chat with RJ Benjamin. I got to know RJ pretty well on Idols when he was our musical director. He's not involved there anymore this year. I think it's Donald, right?
Mm-hmm. Who's come on as a musical mentor.
Okay. And RJ's got an interesting story. I mean, this guy, look at you. Come in here. This guy's had a hell of a career already. And he's nowhere near finished, by the way. He's got lots still to do. Am I right?
No, absolutely.
Well, you better have more to do.
No, look,
we aren't finished with you.
There's nothing else I can do. You know, I mean, I had this argument with my mother about 10 years ago or something like that. You know, where she was like, maybe it's time. I don't know if this ever happened to you, but my mother every now and then would be like, maybe it's time for you to get a real job. You know?
No. Yes, it happens all the time. RJ Benjamin, how dare your mother say that? You've done such a lot for South African music. You've done such a lot to enhance our lives with your music.
Well, thanks, man.
And it would be a sadness if you hadn't gone into this career. What was your backup plan? Did you have one?
I had zero backup plan. I will tell you. So when I finished school, in my mind, probably since I was 5, 6, 7, somewhere around there, it was. I kind of knew or believed very strongly it was going to be music. I just had a very strong self-belief, and it was a very private belief. No one even knew I could sing until I was about 16 or 17.
Oh, really? You didn't show off?
No. For me, it was my way of, I don't know, expressing what was going on in my life, and I would go and I'd write songs, and I did that from about 5 or 6, somewhere around there.
Wow.
And just built this big catalog of songs, which I still have to this day. And I mean, those songs have made me lots of money. But when I finished school, my mom still was like, I don't think you should be doing music. And for some reason, she thought I should be doing like film or TV.
Huh. And she didn't have this belief that you had.
No, she didn't. But the film thing was a complete failure for that year. I joined an agency and was like a body double in a few American movies for some American actors who were sort of short and looked like a white Jewish guy like me or something. I don't know. And that was a complete failure.
It's a fairly limited category. Short, white Jewish guys.
You're
a body double.
I did a shower scene with some American.
Oh, really?
That
sounds
good.
That
was my one claim to fame. You know, I need to find that movie though and show my wife.
What part were you doubling up for? Because you know, you get people who like a butt double, or no, this is the real thing.
My buddy's right.
There was an actor named Rob Morrow. You'd have to Google him. I suppose I did kind of look similar to him. And apparently, in his contract in the movie, the director or the producers missed it, but he refused to do shower scenes or something to that effect.
I love that. These guys are their principals.
Yeah. So they offered me some more money, and that stage it was like, wow, that is a lot of money. You know, compared to, let's just say, getting paid as being an extra or, you know, something like that. So I was like, I'll do it. And they put you in this like skin color or, you know, kind of a little...
Like a mankini.
That thing. Is it like a flesh speedo?
To that effect. It's a flesh speedo.
Oh, wow.
They totally put you in a flesh speedo. And you have to touch, you know, put base or powder in your area just to make sure all blending. You know?
Oh, my.
And then off
How
you go.
Very detailed.
Off you go into the shower. She was a very, very attractive actress. So, I mean.
All right.
I was a 19-year-old. I was like, wow, this is
19
fun.
Years old?
Yeah, this
you
is
were
super fun. I did my shower scene. So, I've actually never watched the movie. But I can definitely find out what it is.
And you've never watched your own scene in the movie?
I've been too afraid. I've been too scared.
Why?
I don't know, you know. I don't know.
That would be how I start every dinner party. Like,
you're exactly.
Good evening, welcome.
You're a very strange dude. I mean,
I do remember the movie was called Only Love. I do know that.
Okay, so, I mean, you didn't start singing until you were 16. You won't see your own shower scene in Only Love. What's going on here?
Well, look, then the year after that, I just basically said to my mom, look, I have nothing else. You've got to let me study music. And off I went and I studied at this little college campus called Allenby Campus.
Right.
Which is where I actually met Proverb.
Right.
Elvis Blue was a year below me when we were studying.
Huh.
It was a very interesting bunch of people. DJ Clear was studying sound engineering at the same institution.
Mm.
And we all became friends. It was like this little interesting family of people who all happened to come to the same tiny little campus in Bramley, Johannesburg, and we've all become successful out of that. But
that's an amazing collection of people.
It really is. It really is, man. And I mean, you know, the interesting thing for me is that we've all kind of stayed connected through all these years. And I mean, this was 2000, I think. So it's a long time ago now. And for me, I mean, look, studying music, if someone came to me and said, should I study music, I'd probably say no, because the odds of you actually graduating and then having a career in music is very slim.
Yeah.
It is
being
really
able to pay
slim.
Any bills at all.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's tough, right?
100%. So, for that fact and, you know, like within those 2-3 years where you had guys like Proverb, Cleo, myself, Elvis Blue, there's a bunch of other guys, Ray Green, who plays guitar on Idols.
Yeah, also very talented.
He was there. He blows my mind. He's a guitaring genius. I mean, he was there as well. There's a few guys. It was just an incredible time. I feel very lucky to have been there at the time. And then from there, I became a teacher, actually.
Yes, that's right. I remember that.
I thought, okay, well, here's the backup plan, you know, boom, got it, you know, got a teaching post because, you know, most guys are not going to crack it in the industry. And from there, I thought, okay, well.
Was your mother satisfied then? Oh, well, he's a teacher.
Totally.
Yeah, then she was, because that sounds, totally. You see, this is the thing about that generation, right? They want you to have a job title that gives them security.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's not about you being happy or pursuing your dreams, because that's a very millennial thing. For
Absolutely,
their generation, it's like, you've got to have stability.
Mm.
You've got to be guaranteed an income. Now, if you're a teacher, it's not a lot of income, but it's an income for the rest of your life.
Well, exactly.
Keep doing it until you're 65.
Yeah, for them, they think a job must last you for the next 4 or 5 decades.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's just not how we are wired
anymore. We're definitely not wired like that anymore.
No.
You know, we're caged animals who just want to kind of break free. And
every 3 years, you want to try something new.
Absolutely, man. Life is short.
So how long did the teaching thing last?
It actually lasted a long time, but it opened doors into other things. So, so the teaching, I taught until about 2009.
And you were teaching music. You would teach people how to play instruments, how to write music, how to read music.
How to arrange. Yeah.
I mean, these are almost lost skills.
They are lost skills. I can tell you this, what I tried to do, especially early on with the teaching, because I taught at the National School of Arts a bit. I taught at St. Stithians. I taught at quite a few schools around Joburg.
Right.
And what I did try and do is teach via experience. So the teaching opened up doors. I basically got my record deal off the back of teaching Irvin Swerve. He was like one of the first guys on Big Brother. He brought a guy named Kaz Abrams along. He used to be a TV presenter.
I remember
presenter.
Kaz and Irv, yeah.
And Kaz kind of walked into my office and he saw, like, I don't know, I was obsessed with Prince. I was obsessed with Prince and Erykah Badu and D'Angelo and Maxwell. That was like my thing.
Who wouldn't be?
Exactly,
That's
right?
That's a good list.
So there were these pictures and Kaz was also a fan. So he's like, oh, you're a fan of these guys? Do you do that kind of music? I was like, yeah. He's like, oh, play me some stuff. So I played him stuff on the piano. And next thing I know, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. Got a kind of deal. Well, got a deal with him. He hooked up a deal with Ghetto Ruff, and next thing I'm an artist with Ghetto Ruff, and that kind of just opened up my career there. Recorded my demo at Jazzworks, which of course is Robin Cole, Lyra's husband. And this was pre-Lyra, but we became very good friends. I started doing a lot of production and writing work at Jazzworks, so it opened up all these doors. And it wouldn't have happened if I wasn't teaching. But then what I tried to do is I tried to take the teach my students experiences from the perspective of now, I'm a recording artist. This is what happens in studio. This is what happens when you perform on stage. This is what happens when you're producing an artist in a recording studio. This is what happens when you're writing a song. And it was so nice that I could basically be one of those kind of teachers who wasn't simply just teaching, but was actually doing.
You were doing, yeah, absolutely. Because they often say that horrible, I don't like this line at all, but people say, you know, those who can't do teach.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which is awful, because there are a lot of people who are doing far more good for society, for the individual talents that they rear, the minds that they open up,
no doubt
that they're doing a whole lot more than just teaching. And I think it's also being a teacher, being a really good teacher is a calling. It's just an incredible ability that some people don't have.
Yeah, I mean, I miss it a lot. I've got to say, like, there is something so gratifying about teaching, about imparting knowledge, and especially when it's a student who takes that knowledge and just rolls with it.
But isn't it also stressful, because at the same time as you're teaching all these kids, you also have your own career going on, your music career, which had just begun. And you're worried about a misstep over here, which could affect the other business.
Yeah.
You know, your teaching is going to look silly if you fail performer stroke artist. Mm. And if you're a really great artist, it's going to steal you away from your teaching. So you're kind of playing this balancing game the whole time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was the dichotomy, especially at that time. And I really started, I mean, four sort of different spheres of my career like became very obvious to me. So the one was teaching, the one was being a music producer, the one was being a songwriter, and the one was being an artist. And then I was always sort of torn, like, because at different points in time, different ones were doing well for me, you know, and I couldn't focus 100% on one of them.
Did you have anyone who was able to give you advice at that point? Was there anyone who you could rely on to say, look, I'm focusing a little bit more on the production and arrangement stuff, because I think that's where I have a talent that nobody else does. That's something that I can do to earn money. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? Or did that stuff not enter? Did you not have anyone you could bounce that stuff
in? I didn't have, let's say, a manager who could advise me like that. Not then, not early on. I had people within each of those spheres who had their own interests at heart. And it's not necessarily their fault, you know. So, a Kaz or a Lance Sturr, who were really like, their interest was that I sell albums and perform a lot. That was, so they would always say, this is the priority and you must focus on this. In fact, there was a stage when, and I didn't have to listen to Lance, but he insisted that I stop teaching altogether because it was taking away from the artist side of things. But now, what happened from that is, I did that and then I was like, oh no, I don't have that stability anymore. That constant income stability, because especially then when you're just starting to build that career and maybe the gigs aren't coming in flowing, and after having, let's say, 4 years or 3 years of like a monthly salary, there's a strong power in a monthly salary. You know?
Oh yeah, that's why a lot of people choose that, and I keep saying to everybody who, you know, wants to be an entrepreneur or they want to go into some very risky career, all these people think they're somehow superior. They're not. You could be a lot smarter and just take a salary. You really could.
Yeah. I mean,
a lot of us should just settle for that, because that's good enough.
Yeah, it is. You know, I think you've got to know what your life's plan is. I mean, the obvious thing about not having a salary and being freelance, so to speak, is that the risk is much higher.
Yeah.
The rewards might be much higher too, but it's like investing in shares, you know.
Sure, you never know.
Yeah, are you someone who wants to take risks and wants to experience life that way? I mean, they are added. I think it depends on the kind of person you are, you know.
So when did you first get the idea that this could be a full-time career for you? Because in 2005 you got a SAMA nomination for the best adult contemporary. Was that kind of a pointer in the right direction? Was it when you were the vocal coach on Project Fame? How did you get the idea that this is something you wanted to do full time?
I think it was all of that. I mean, prior to being the vocal coach on Project Fame, Lance Egereff, and I love Lance. I just want to make that clear. But he said to me, he was like, I mean, we had recorded a lot of songs for my first album. And at that stage, he basically said, like, There's nothing
that's
strong
enough.
That's
who I am, right?
That's who I am. That's right. That was the album. And he said, there's nothing really strong enough. I'm not convinced. You know, and obviously this is like your heart and soul. So, you know, it's like these ripping that out of you, you know. And interestingly enough, Project Fame confirmed to me that as a personality, there are people who seem, you know, seem to resonate with me. And that convinced him that this could work. And he basically said to me, if you can record like three or four songs that might have a bit more sort of commercial appeal, let's do this. And that's what I did. Collaborated with Bongani Fassie, collaborated with Tomorrow Day, collaborated with
Pitch Black Afro.
Correct. And we did some fun stuff, man. I mean, it's still stuff that, at least from a musical integrity perspective, I still listen back and I'm like, that is really cool. You know, I still like this, which for me is always the great test. If you can listen back to your stuff and kind of be like, that still sounds dope.
And it doesn't feel like it's this dated thing, right?
Yeah.
Because 10 years on, most music sounds a little dated.
Yeah, and in the music industry, you are always pressured to try and hit that trend, you know, and you've got to have a hit.
Be as fresh as possible.
Absolutely.
All right, so let's just fast forward a little. Project Fame, I mean, very few of us even remember Project Fame. I've got to be honest with you, that was kind of an America's Got Talent type thing, but it was... It was also part reality show because you
that's right.
followed these people around and you Big saw some of the stuff that went on in the house that they all stayed in. And, I mean, was that your first entry into television as well?
It was. It was my first experience, obviously. I mean, interestingly, I didn't know...
Who was on that show that I would know? Besides you, obviously.
Tracy Lee Oliver. I don't know if you know.
She's a comedian
and the actress. Yes.
She's a phenomenal vocalist. Who else? There's a Nigerian recording artist named Dare.
Okay.
Who's big in Nigeria.
Oh, he does like a lot of ballads, doesn't he?
He does a lot of ballads. Uh-huh. He's got a song called Pray For Me, which is very big. But he's done very well in Nigeria. Beyond that, I mean, the winner... I remember there was a big controversy with her. I think she was from Zambia.
Yeah.
And if I recall correctly, Sony were having a problem because they didn't quite believe that she was a sellable artist. So even though she won and she got the record deal, they didn't know how to sell her.
See a lot of people into these reality shows and they think when they win it, that's the guaranteed key to...
Making it.
Yeah, fortune and fame and everything.
Oh, Nathan Rowe.
Okay, yeah, of course. What a talented dude.
He was on that.
Wasn't he hectically Christian back in those days as well? That's what he said. He was super Christian.
True.
Just like, that totally was his agenda.
That's very funny.
He really was.
Okay, our Nathan.
He's awesome, man.
All right, now, a lot of people think that these shows are going to make them. And then sometimes there's huge disappointment ahead because what you do afterwards is almost more important than what happens during the show.
Absolutely. No one would know that better than you.
Yeah, the show ends and then we all stop caring about you.
Yeah.
As a contestant, from that moment on, it's all down to you.
Absolutely.
Because you're never going to get as much publicity or interest as you do at the moment of your winning.
Right.
It's never going to be that good.
No.
So you reach the apex right at the start. Which is a horrible place to go because the only way you can go is down.
Yeah, it's quite a scary formula.
It is, and that's why these shows are not sustainable for careers. They're fine to get publicity. They're fine to get exposure, to allow people to see what you can do and show off a little bit. But really, your career begins the day afterwards.
And I think for me, if you look at the most successful, let's say winners or contestants from these shows, there's more there than just a great voice that can cover someone else's song and sing it really
correct.
Well. Elvis Blue, Kaya had more there. Heinz had more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Amanda Black has more. I just remember, you know, during the week when we were learning songs, you know, she would play some songs for me. You know, in the rooms, I was certainly aware that this girl has more there than just being a cover singer who wants to be famous. Hmm. She had substance. She was writing songs. She was a musician. She played piano. She played guitar.
Hmm.
It's those sort of multifaceted contestants that are the ones that I generally find are successful, whether you win or not. You know, you can cover Whitney as well as you want, and that might blow people away on TV. But at the end of the day, you know, if you don't have a body of work possibly already prepared, and you don't know your musical identity,
yeah,
you're in big trouble.
Now, what about the kinds of different television shows? Because you did Project Fame, then you also went on to do Clash of the Choirs.
Yeah,
you also went on to do Idols. Mm. I mean, how did they all differ for you? Having experienced all of those.
I mean...
And The Voice, and right?
I did a little bit of... In fact, I've just finished a stint. I think the reason why I'm looking like a wild man is I just finished a stint on The Voice Nigeria.
Yes.
Oh.
That must be interesting.
That was fascinating. It's so different to anything I've done in South Africa. Look, Project Fame, from what I can remember... I was just having an absolute ball. I think it was 21 or 22, somewhere around there, maybe 23. I don't know. But I was having so much fun because mm-hmm. this was TV and it was my first time. And I think...
you get swept up in the whole
you
thing.
You totally get swept up in the hype. And it was the first time I experienced when you're walking through a mall and then people start recognizing you, you know, mm-hmm. And you get caught up in that false reality as well, which is, you know, yes, it's me thing, which is, and the fascinating thing for me is as soon as that show finished, it's as though people completely forgot who I was. It was like I never existed.
Jeez.
And it's that fame monster.
People are fickle, hey? We're fickle.
People are fickle, but it's that fame monster as well. You might think it won't affect you, you know, but... It affects you because when you see that recognition and then all of a sudden it's not there and then you're like, oh my God.
What have I done wrong?
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
am I irrelevant now?
100%.
That kind of crap.
And that doesn't necessarily make you relevant or irrelevant, but it was a great learning curve for me. Clash of the Choirs was really, really cool for me because the format did not exist in South Africa and we had to try... I was brought in right at the beginning and we basically had to try and make the format make sense in a South African context. And that meant that I had a lot of creative control in how we run the show. The idea of the show then was basically, this is not a gospel show. Yes, there are choirs, but we want to show that choirs can sing any genre you want. Choirs can do hip hop. Choirs can do kwaito. You know, which gave me a lot of creative freedom there, and it was incredible. It was a lot of fun for me. I learned a lot doing that. It was high pressure.
That show is massive,
and it was really big. It still is big, and I hope it comes back. We'll see what happens. I mean, I know Kaya took over for season 3. But it's still a strong show, no doubt. And for me, the skills I learned on Clash of the Choirs, and I suppose Project Fame to a degree, helped me when I did start on Idols SA, which for me is just such an incredible... Well, Gavin Ratten, who...
the director,
producer. He really produces a smooth-running show. I mean, that show is... I mean, obviously compared to Clash, you know, which was like
a bit chaotic.
We were all trying to figure it out. And like running around. I feel like if someone has footage of me behind the scenes, I was literally running around like this, going, like, "Ah, fuck!" So that's what I was expecting out of Idols. I thought this is how these shows roll. And I went to Idols and it was just like everything's so smooth. I mean, it was still high pressure, especially for us behind the scenes because we need to deliver. I know you saw me a few times in the crowd looking like super serious.
Yeah, you were. But these were your pupils. You were the teacher again.
I was the teacher again.
And on the show, you would talk them into how they had to perhaps arrange something, how they should maybe try and show off this or not do that too much.
Yeah.
I mean, you were really the coach that they needed.
That's absolutely because
that's a hard role to take on, you see, especially because you're also a singer.
Yeah. So I found myself, especially on Idols, kind of living through them to a degree. So when they're on stage, I know what they've been through. I've seen every single run. I saw them do the very first, let's say...
It drove you mad. I would say to you after the show, this one was crap. And you'd say, but they were so good in rehearsal. That drove you crazy, right?
It's the most hot. I mean, it's live TV. The fact is, everyone, including yourselves, were watching this for the first time. And so you can only judge it on that one.
We never saw rehearsals.
Which is fair enough. And as they say, I mean, it's a classic saying, you're only good as your last performance. Mm. So, it's absolutely heartbreaking when you see these people who were killing it. Like, let's say in the afternoon, absolutely killing it. Like, you thought, like, people are going to lose their minds over this.
And then it just... 3 hours later, they screw it up royally.
Man, it's the most heartbreaking feeling when you see that happen.
Is that just because the stage gets the better of them? I mean, it must be very high pressure.
It is. It's the pressure.
It's the stage. It's the crowd. It's the it's the fact that you know that the whole country's... It's live. Mm. Live. There's no... Yeah. You know, rehearsal, you get it wrong. Ah, it's the rehearsal.
Yes.
You screw up on live television, that adds a whole new dynamic. And that's what you'll be known for forever.
100%.
You're the person who fell down during this routine. You're the person who messed up the lyrics to this song.
Yeah.
It counts.
And I think the thing is, especially when, if you make, it's like a domino effect. So if you start your song and you make one mistake, that, you know, it's live TV. You know, this is the performance. You know, there's all these people watching. There's the judges watching and ready to crit. And all of this is going on in your head, and you've got like 2.5 minutes, and that can eat you up inside. So it becomes a ripple effect. So you screw up sort of at the beginning, and then the whole thing just becomes
cascades out of control. Man.
And sometimes what I found on the show actually is, it might have been, we were all talking sort of behind the scenes, going, "Oh, the judges are going to love this show. This is a great show." And then it turned out to be like the worst of the whole season, because it's also a ripple effect. So if the judges rip into, let's say, the first person, that next person is like, "Oh my god, they're going to kill me," and then it just becomes like a one after the next, just kind of don't deliver.
It's horrible.
Oh. Worst feeling ever.
So, at the end of last year's season, did you just decide you'd had enough?
I was actually around for Theatre Week this year.
Oh, were you?
Okay. I was.
Because I wasn't. I don't know if you noticed.
I noticed, man. I noticed,
don't know whether you've noticed.
I noticed. I was like, something's missing.
Oh, so, I decided I didn't feel like doing this.
I think we all noticed. A few of the core music team people left. Marley Kelly left.
Oh, she left as well.
And a guy named Jadeen Barron left.
Mm-hmm.
And myself, Jadeen, and Marley were really the core music team. Okay. And we created quite a strong team and unit for the years that we were on Idols. As soon as I started, there was a lot of my musical understanding, ideology, as far as The Voice goes, which was very similar to Marley. So that bond was already very strong.
Mm.
When they left, I didn't think, okay, well, I'm going to leave. But there was a new music team that replaced them, who are working on Idols now.
Yeah.
And just based on that, I felt that I was potentially going to be a third wheel in that situation. You know that kind of thing when, like, you're the old guy on the team and you've got your old ways and you can't, like, get out of them. And you've got these new people here who want to try and push, like, their sort of new ideas and stuff. And I didn't want to be the guy kind of...
Who stopped them.
Who stopped them. And I could completely see myself being totally grumpy and, I don't know, like that curmudgeonly old man... Kind of just,
but it takes some serious courage to be able to step away from something that you've been a huge part of, and where you've contributed to the success the way that you had, and also where you have a feeling of family, right? And so for you, it was probably really difficult to make that decision, but it was the right decision for you and for the show.
I think so. You know, because it's better for the show. It can. There's a new team. They're a fresh team.
Yeah.
They can take it into a new direction. For me, watching, I'm going, okay, I know that would have annoyed the crap out of me, so thank God I'm not involved in that.
Right. Now you can finally watch. You've watched since you left?
I've watched bits and pieces. It's not easy, as you say, because these people were your family. You know, so it's like watching an ex-girlfriend with another guy.
Ooh. So well, you're waiting to maybe, see, will they be happy?
Maybe
is
you're right.
Cuter than
maybe
Z?
You're right. I haven't watched yeah. I haven't watched a single episode. I don't have, obviously it's not because I don't care about the people who are on the show. I love the people on the show. I don't watch reality TV.
Yeah. I think for me it's homework to a degree, you know. If I'm still working on these kinds of shows and there are new ones being conceptualized as well,
that's a bit of a cottage industry then as well for you. I mean, it's something that you are positioned uniquely to do,
and
hence Nigeria.
Absolutely. I mean, it was a strategy of mine. I wanted to know how I could spread knowledge, transfer skills, to a degree, discover talent. I know that. Especially in the early stages, you are more involved with that than I am. But whatever talent eventually gets funneled, I want to know that I can try and develop that as as far as possible. And these shows afforded me that. They also afforded me the luxury of not feeling the pressure of having to make music commercially that had to be a hit. I suppose I was becoming a bit of a hippie as far as that's concerned in the fact that I was like, I want to make music that I enjoy, you know, like, I don't want to make
that,
a trap
that's
song,
the purist in you,
the purist in me. But this entire sort of model of my career completely afforded me that luxury, you know. Hire a 11-piece band with a brass section and, you know, the best musicians in the country and stick them in a studio and let's just have fun and let's just record, you know, because
it's amazing.
Do
awards mean anything to you? I mean, you've collected a few over the years.
Not really. It's
you got the Metro FM award, you got the best R&B album in that same year.
Yeah,
a couple of Samas there. There's some good stuff on your shelf. Do you put them up anywhere?
I don't actually.
Where are they? In boxes?
They're in boxes.
What?
They're in boxes. In fact, I hide them from my wife because she's like, where are they? Show me where those awards are. We need to put them up. And I'm like, I will never tell you. So, because I mean, she's obviously proud, of whatever I've achieved. She's a very talented actress herself. So I'm assuming awards will eventually start rolling in.
Will you put her awards up?
That's entirely up to her. I certainly won't be like, give me that award. I'm putting it in a box. But,
why do you feel the need to hide them?
It's not. For me, the awards are not the priority. I'm very proud of whatever I have achieved and whatever has been, but it's not the priority for me. And I never want to get it twisted that's why I do this. I just want to try and make good music. I just want to try and contribute and make the industry better.
Jeez, I would be using my awards as utensils.
See, I would have every picture on social media would have them in the background.
Bang, okay, bang.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of understand what you're saying. At the same time, to get a music award for anything, for a song, for an album, for a composition, for production, for whatever it might be, that's people who, outside... People who aren't involved in the process with you, they look at this stuff and they go, this guy is really doing good stuff. It's a massive compliment.
Yeah, I suppose it's that purest thing that you were talking about earlier in me. And it's been, I mean, for example, in my biography for a while, I insisted that whoever was helping me write it just don't really include that. You know, I don't really want to talk about it.
But it's important. People put huge stake in
they
that.
They do put value in it. I mean, this is the truth.
So then they'll say, oh, we've got Sama award winning or Metro FM award winning RJ Benjamin on this project.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for them, it does help. It's like an Oscar award to an actress.
That
means that she's going to be able to charge more for the next movie she's in.
No, I mean, look, you're 100% correct. I think for me, in my own space, especially at home, that's why I'm okay to sort of put these things on paper now. I mean, Clash of the Choir season 2 won a SAFTA, and that's another thing I'm very proud of. In my own space, I suppose I know the awards are there. I think visually speaking, I almost feel like that is not why I'm doing this, and I don't ever want to twist my career towards like, this is why I'm doing it. I'm doing it so I can get an award. I'm doing it so I can create good music. If that earns me an award, that's cool.
Yeah, then it's a compliment. All right, so let's talk about this wife of yours.
Right.
Chantel. Yes. All right, because she's been in Sierra Leone. You guys started dating in, what, 2013?
Yeah, in fact.
How did that relationship start?
Well, the relationship started it started just post... We met post Project Fame. One of the contestants on Project Fame was a girl named Robin, who lived in Cape Town. And after Project Fame, I think the year later, I'd released my album, and she was doing a show in Cape Town somewhere.
Right.
And I went to go watch, and one of the other female performers was Chantel, who I must have found very attractive, because she gave me a copy of my album and said, please autograph this. And I did, and I even left my number.
And the thing... operator.
And I mean, I was with someone else at the time. So
that's the move.
That was I was taking advantage. You're a fan. Anyway, so.
But she's very hot. I mean, let's not mess around. She's really
hot.
Beautiful. She's a beautiful woman. She would come with you to Idols sometimes.
Yeah, she would.
And she'd be sitting there with you, and she always just looked almost a goddess. She had this. Hair and she'd do it differently every time, and she'd wear these little outfits. And good-looking woman. No, you're proud of her, right?
I am super proud of her. I mean, she's hot, man. She's a fox.
Yeah, and you two are a bit of a power couple there. You'd pitch up, and you could see she was really proud of you and all the work that you were doing. Yeah. She knew how much you'd put into each of the performances. And then she could sit there too, and people would go, "Wow, she's." RJ's wife, but she's also on TV and she's got all this stuff going on. It's nice.
There's definitely a power couple thing there. I mean, we
own it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can't deny it. But then,
and she's a sweetheart, though.
Yes, she is.
Oh yeah.
Every time I bump into her, she's the sweetest of people.
That's for me one of the best qualities. You know, like she's a good human being. I'm not saying she doesn't get vus.
She's from the Cape.
Absolutely. And she does not take cuck, as they would say.
Now, let's just talk about the cultural differences here, because this must be something to behold. Mm. So here we have RJ Benjamin. He's a good Jewish boy. Yeah. Now you got her. She's a colored girl from the flats, nothing from Judaism. Know nothing about the flats. How the hell did the two of you, how do the families get on? How does this work?
Well, look, I've always been a bit of a free spirit when it comes to relationships, which definitely hasn't made my mother happy. And
this poor, long-suffering mother of yours.
Shame, your career makes her unhappy.
Oh. Yeah.
No, she's a lot happier now, believe me. She's very proud now. But
sure.
I had just ended this relationship with a girl who was 18 at the time, wasn't Jewish, who didn't even come from South Africa, and so this was a long distance relationship. She was in the UK, and that ended in turmoil. And then my mother basically said, "Okay, so you're a 30-something-year-old guy, mid-30s or whatever. I think it's time you owe me trying to meet a Jewish girl."
You owe me.
And this was 2013. And so I was like, okay, deal. I'll give you a year. You've got a year. If you can find me a Jewish girl in 2013, then you at least... after this, if it doesn't work, we can say we tried. And... unfortunately, my eye was wandering. I was going on due dates.
Your mother must have been shidduching up a storm.
Oh, she was. She was.
She
totally
must have called up every single Jewish girl of the appropriate age range
who was singing.
She must have been working that phone. I reckon she had broadcast lists going on her phone. Huh?
Going through scratching names.
Come and meet RJ. He's wonderful.
There was definitely that going on. Yeah. I went on lots of Jew girl dates.
Operation.
And no, it was happening. It was on. Nothing was quite sort of clicking, because I'd been in the music industry for a while. You become kind of part of this wider
circle. That almost
circle.
Becomes your culture.
100%.
Yeah.
And I was just... it wasn't really working. Chantel sent me a tweet. I mean, this was obviously happening now, parallel to the Jew girl dates. Chantel sent me a tweet sometime in the year. I think it was around July, saying drive. She was doing a show in Turkey, like a 6-month contract. doing like these this 80s show in Turkey. She's a singer as well, good dancer as well.
Uh-huh. Multi-talented,
yeah. And she sent me a message. She was listening to my first album, Who I Am, while they were driving through the mountains of Turkey somewhere. And she said, I'd listen to your album Missing Home or something. And somehow that eventually landed up us chatting in DMs on Twitter.
You've got to take it to the DMs if you want some privacy.
100%. I went to the DMs.
Yeah.
And I just decided, I was like, I'm just going to ask her, are you single? And, you know, obviously this was not to my mom. To my mom's knowledge at all, but I was like, you know, she's really hot. I need to find out, is she single? And she said, yes, I am. And at some point, I actually had to stop us chatting. It had eventually obviously moved to WhatsApp, but I had to stop us chatting.
Because that's how you could tell if a relationship's serious. Starts off publicly, nobody really is any the wiser. Then it goes to DMs in Twitter. Then it goes from there into the WhatsApps. You know, then you know you're serious.
I know, this is getting serious.
Okay.
And at some stage, I actually had to tell her it's not going to happen. I promised my mom. I even told her. I told her the
really?
Story. I totally did. And then I eventually, after one more sort of Jewish girl relationship that didn't work out, I was like, nah, you know what? Screw this. Called my mom. I'm like, Ma, I've given you like 8 months.
It's not working.
It's not working. There's this girl. She's in Turkey. And we're just clicking. And
you said there was a girl in Turkey. Your mother must have had an apoplexy.
Yeah, another long distance relationship.
Hi, they a Turkish girl.
That's right. Is she
Muslim?
Oh my god!
How am I going to explain this to your aunt? How am I going to explain this to everybody? This is going to be a disaster.
Yeah, I know.
So she managed to survive that. Your mom.
Managed to survive that. I basically said, Chantel, are you willing to wait? Because she was only going to be back in October.
Yeah.
Or November, something like that. And she's like, I'm willing to wait. So I said, well, let's do it. Let's wait. We waited it out.
Did you know she was the one?
Yeah.
You did?
I did.
And did she know you were the one?
You'd have to ask her. I think it was pretty... We were pretty confident from very early on. Especially once we sort of met face-to-face after mm-hmm. this pretty, you know, like 4 or 5 month long distance relationship. Once we met face to face, we were pretty convinced.
If a guy can have a long distance relationship, then it only intensifies when you're actually around her.
Oh,
right.
Man, it really does.
Women are so much more evolved than us. They can actually feel across distance and time. And women have an ability that we don't to connect in a very real way.
Yeah.
Whether it's messages or phone calls or whatever. Absolutely. Women can connect like that. Men, if there is a physical presence, it really helps.
Absolutely. I agree.
So when she arrived back here, how long until you took her to meet your mother, who was by now so disappointed she was ready to go to the grave?
She probably was. I mean, obviously to me, she's like, oh, I'm so happy
I'm
for,
so happy
you know,
for you, but
know
she, you know.
Meanwhile.
I think I know.
So how long did you wait before you took her to meet your mom?
I think it was probably about a month.
Okay.
You know, and the thing about Chantel is, whether she's Jewish or not, she is a very... likeable human being. She's extremely intelligent, far more intelligent than I am, and just a magnetic personality. You know, that family dinner, which I now know she was completely freaking out about, because I think it was Shabbos at my mother on a Friday night. Not just meeting my mom and her my stepdad, but also meeting my sister and her family.
Okay,
and. She's so likable, you know. Like it's hard not to find this.
She won them over.
She won them over. I won't. I mean, in this, there are lots of people in my family who I'm now estranged to.
Oh, people who disapproved. Don't you love that? There's always some douchebag somewhere in the family who thinks it's their business to approve or disapprove of you.
Yeah.
Isn't that incredible? Here in 2017.
Yeah. I mean, look, for me, it's just a hands up in the air.
Yeah.
Maybe eventually we'll sort this out.
But in the meantime, you're going to live your life and you're going to be happy. Absolutely, and you're going to start a future and make it work for you guys.
100%. I prioritize.
You got married
happiness.
In 2015, right?
2015. Yeah. Yeah.
And now her family, tell me about them.
I was absolutely freaking out about meeting her family because the previous relationship, the mother, that mother tried to make my life a misery. I mean, there's a whole story in that. I mean, they come from Zimbabwe, Bulawayo, which is actually where my mother comes from.
Yes.
And in fact, your manager.
Yeah, Rena's from there as well.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So she knew my mom. And so, you know, it was interesting going back to Bulawayo, but I eventually got kicked out of Bulawayo, like literally kicked out of a home.
Wow.
Physically. And I mean, I felt like my life was threatened by these people.
Jesus.
There was a lot of hate going on there. So that was my last experience with
parents. What did you do?
Parents. Look, I was an older guy dating their precious younger daughter.
Oh, and they thought that you were some kind of a predator.
I think so. I think so. I
think it's safe.
It's something like that. Yeah. So,
because she was so much younger than you.
Maybe if I look at it from there.
Because she was so much younger than you, so it freaked them out.
I think so. And I was an artist at the time. I was doing a lot of house music. I mean, we're talking 2009, 2010.
So they thought you were a bad influence as well.
A bad influence, you know, bad guy.
Terrible human.
But you had songs like Change the World. You meant well. You know.
No, but I'm just performing to, you know, get with
but
the honeys.
But RJ,
you know?
I mean, you're not an objectionable dude. I can't imagine people getting upset with you.
Oh, gosh.
So yeah. when you meet Chantel's family for the first time, you're nervous?
I was freaking out. I mean, I had a whole fight with Chantel about it because I was so on edge about it. And they're the coolest people, man. I mean, they are very chilled. Her dad is obsessed with reggae.
Oh, yeah?
You know, you walk into the house, they've got Heart FM blaring all the time. With you know, and they're dancing and singing. I don't know. It's just like such a chilled environment. I mean, they're quite religious. But you can completely see that they're extremely proud of their daughter.
Mm-hmm.
They believed in her 100%, even though she took a risk and studied acting, you know, drama, and are okay with the decision, with the life decisions she's made, you know. So there was never a feeling. I've never ever had a feeling from them that they had an issue with me being a Jew, for example, you know, or her marrying a Jew.
Yeah,
never, not once. And I mean, the ceremony was very mixed.
Yeah, what kind of a ceremony did you have?
I mean, it was very uniquely us. We had it in Simonstown.
There must have been some beautiful music.
Oh, yes. I mean, look, we had lots of musos there on both sides. And we thought, we're not taking advantage and asking them to play.
Yeah.
But we were like, we're going to play some of our favorite songs throughout the night. You know, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, Michael Jackson. I think our first dance was... crap, she's going to kill me. Uh-oh. But... Never Too Much, actually, Luther Vandross.
Oh, great song.
I mean, we love... That's our kind of music. That's where we connect, you know, with all that kind of stuff. Earth, Wind & Fire, and I suppose George Benson must be there, Al Jarreau.
That's some funky stuff you've got going on there.
That's where we connect, you know. And I think it makes such a difference when you can connect musically with your partner. You know, like we did... We had this old Israeli lady who's does sort of mixed marriages officiate, and she I can't remember her name right now, but you know, my mom's name's Ora, O-R-A, and of course she's from Israel, so she says Ora, you know, Roy. My name's Roy, so
Roy Benjamin. Yeah. Go on.
Yeah, and we had to take a sip out of this fascinating weird cup. You'd have to go find it on Google. I broke the glass. We completely mixed it.
Right.
Yeah. So my stepdad, if I remember correctly, read a prayer in Hebrew.
Okay.
Her father, Chantal's father, read a prayer in English. Uh-huh. We tried to mix the cultures and try and pay respect to both. I broke the glass. You know, we tried to make sure that we were showing respect to our parents and our cultures and where we came from. And I still absolutely respect my, you know, my culture and my religion.
Absolutely. It's part of you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for us, you know, even going forward, when we have kids, we'll educate them on both, you know?
Yeah, I was just about to ask you, because that's the real test, is what do you teach the kids and what kind of a culture do you raise the kids in?
Yeah, I think we'll try and teach them as best as we can to understand and respect both religions and both cultures. And you know, because they're not only going to have challenges in as far as their mixed, their colored kids, essentially, especially when it comes to, let's say, my Jewish family and being accepted within that family. But they're also going to have those big questions of what's
religion, culture, yeah, all of that
you
stuff.
You know, what's right?
But don't you think ultimately those kids will rule the world? Because they won't. No, I'm not being facetious or flippant about it. Kids like that have got, they can draw on both sides, and they can draw on experience from both sides, and on stories from both sides, and on cultural and historical and religious elements from both sides. It makes them a lot more interesting.
Well, that's it. I want to bring in some interesting offspring to this world.
If you're not going to them, what's the point?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you guys planning this anytime soon, or is it something you've spoken about?
We are planning it. We are planning it soon. There's nothing yet, but you know, Chantal is now has a full time role in an Afrikaans soap on Cape Net.
Which one?
Called Getrouwd met Rugby.
Yes.
Oh.
Okay, that's apparently a really good show. I don't watch a lot of TV, right. So forgive me, but I've heard it's very good.
It's very good and it's very popular. We went to go watch Nathaniel on Saturday night, and she's already starting to get, you know, all the young Afrikaans fans asking her for photos, which is nice to see. So you know that people are watching, she's killing it, man. I mean, you know,
it's a good market to be in.
It's a very good market to be in, and she's got that market. You know, she's bilingual,
mm-hmm.
And I think it helps a lot in as far as her career goes. So I might be the stay at home husband and eventually the stay at home dad. I'm okay with that. I'll just make music on the side.
Yeah, but you can. That's what's nice is you guys can balance the stuff between yourselves.
That's the beauty of it right now. Absolutely, man.
So tell me quickly about All Falls Down.
So All Falls Down, if you were to listen to the entire body of work of the new music, All Falls Down is really where it all started, which is that crazy girl who was too young, whose mother wanted to make my life a misery. And All Falls Down is really just about this chaotic little situation I found myself in, quite a toxic situation. And really just how it's like... sometimes we hold on to the wrong things. Sometimes we struggle to let go. I don't even know why. Things. I mean, we all do this. It's like in physically abusive relationships, it happens all the time. This person is physically hurting you, and yet you just don't want to let go. And I think for me, this was an emotionally abusive relationship, and I just didn't want to let go. And I don't even. I can't quite explain why. And at some point, you just have to let it go, let everything fall apart so you can kind of start from the ground up, retrace your steps, rebuild your life. And that's really what the song was. This song was the beginning of me rebuilding everything. Or, you know, it all falls down.
Wow.
So from there, I had to then start rebuilding so I could get back up.
Got to play it now. Everybody's going to be dissecting the lyrics.
And has Proverb on it.
Has Proverb on it, yeah. Man, he killed it. He absolutely killed it. So.
He's such a good guy, huh?
He is such a good guy, man. And he's a very intuitive human being.
Yeah.
You know? I think that's what makes him such a great presenter, actually, and an interviewer. Just, you know, hip-hop skills aside, you know, like, he is incredibly good at what he does as far as that goes. And I think that feeds into his lyrical, you know, prowess. Because his lyrics can get very deep. Mm-hmm. Even in what you think is a simple song, look further into those lyrics. There's always beautifully deep messages going on within the subject matter.
Well, I got to say that's true for you as well. Whether it's in arrangement and production, which is just almost like magic to me. I mean... I hear the finished product after someone like you has been at work on a song, and it just doesn't even resemble what went in.
Mm.
It's a real skill. It's something very few people have, and that is one of the few things that in music will never be replaced by technology.
Amen.
You need human ears.
Absolutely.
And you need human intuitions.
Oh, yes.
And you are one of the best at it. And we'll play your song in a second, but it's delightful to have you here.
Thanks,
and thank
Eric.
You so much for coming to spend some time with us.
It's been great.
And tell Chantal next time she must come in. Talk to her about what's going on.
If I can wake her up early enough.
Yes. She mustn't be a precious diva actress now. She must come in here one morning. We'll talk to her.
Will do, man. Thanks so much.
Superb. There's RJ Benjamin, everybody. I'm going to play All Falls Down. We'll come back with the unnews, and then we'll wrap it up for this morning. It is Tuesday on CliffCentral.com. Goes around, comes around. RJ Benjamin featuring Proverb and All Falls Down. It is time for the unnews. Let's get into it. Here's what you need to know this morning. King Goodwill Zwelithini wants more money. 60 million rand a year is just not enough. He wants government to come to the party. He says the request isn't unreasonable either, stating that Dudu Mieni wastes billions of state funds a year and she doesn't even host a reed dance. SABC have apologized for demeaning Dr. Nkosasana Dlamini Zuma this year during various news bulletins, from calling her Mini Zuma to simply Jacob Zuma's ex. The national broadcaster have acknowledged their mistakes. They did, however, also remind Dlamini Zuma that she needs to pay her TV license, to which she said that was Ujacob's responsibility. And finally, Alistair Kutsia says the Bucks will bounce back this week. He doesn't know how, but he says they will. He also said a week is a long time in rugby, especially when there's a long weekend. So he's really expecting his team to give 110% this weekend, which will hopefully be 10% more than what the Wallabies will give. That's our Alistair Kutsia, full of brilliant maths and positive thinking. We will see you tomorrow. It's 9 o'clock, cliffcentral.com.
This is CliffCentral.com.